was one of those phone calls you just hate to get because you know it isn't going to be good. I'd already been asleep about a couple of hours. It was after midnight, and the phone sitting on the nightstand rang. And I thought, oh no, this is not going to be good. And so I picked it up and answered it, and Sarah was on the other end of the line. Sarah was one of the young people who grew up in the congregation where I was preaching at that time. And at this point, she had already graduated. She was off at school somewhere. And now she's calling me at almost 1 o'clock in the morning. At first, I couldn't tell what she was saying because her words were constantly broken by her sobs. She was crying. And so it took a minute or two for her to compose herself before she could begin to get out what had happened that evening. She'd been studying in the student center, and a guy that she knew had a class or two with had come in and sat out, and they began to talk together. And as they talked for a while, the conversation found its way around to faith. No accident, to be sure, because Sarah liked sharing her faith with other people. And so they began to talk about faith. And as they made their way to that subject, this guy began to ask her some questions, began to challenge her, and began to critique what she had been saying. And she said, David, you know, I didn't really know how to respond to some of the things that he was saying. I'd never heard some of this before. I'd never had my faith criticized in this way. And so this guy began to pick up on that she was a little uncertain and a little unsettled. And man, that was like blood in the water to a shark, man. He started going after her and began peppering her with one question after another. And the more she struggled, the more aggressive he became. And she said, he hardly gave me a chance to say anything after a while. And she said, not that it would have mattered, because honestly, some of these criticisms I'd never thought about, I'd never heard before, and I really wasn't sure what I would say to him, even if he'd given me the chance. And she came away from the conversation terribly disappointed, feeling like here was a moment where she was supposed to be ready to give an answer for the hope that was in her. And she didn't really give a good answer. She was terribly disappointed with herself. I could tell talking to her that it had all really rattled her. But I have to confess, brothers and sisters, that it rattled me too. I mean, listen, I'd had this girl in Bible class for 4 years, all through high school, and she was sharp. Sarah was smart. She was a good Bible student. She had thought about the evidence that confirmed the things that she believed. And if ever there were a young person ready to go off to college and stand up to the skeptics and answer for her faith, I would have said, Sarah's ready. So I was rattled by the whole thing too. And it stirred my mind again and made me think about what kinds of things we need to be doing to get our kids ready to face the skeptics. And so I wanted to share that story with you as we start today, because I wanted to stir your hearts to be ready to think with me about 2 Peter chapter 3. Will you go there in your Bible this morning? 2 Peter chapter 3, because as Peter writes this letter, he's thinking about skeptics too. That the disciples who received this letter are going to face. And so his purpose, at least in part, in writing this letter, is to warn them and prepare them for dealing with these mockers. And I have to tell you, as I was reading here in chapter 3 a few months ago, it occurred to me that Peter says some things about them that sound really familiar. And he says some things that I think can help me and you in our own time, in our own generation, as we square up with the skeptics and try to share faith against those who would resist and mock. But I have to tell you that as I thought about that, I was especially thinking about our young people. So underneath all that I want to say today, I'm thinking about that, and I hope you'll think about that with me too. Not that we all don't have to deal with skeptics, we do. But I also think even those of us who are older and are gray-headed or don't have any hair at all, we know it's a different kind of world, right? And that increasingly our kids are facing off with a world full of unbelievers and skeptics and mockers. And we want to be ready for that. So I think there are some things here that will help our kids. In fact, I would suggest some things that will help them to be skeptical about the skeptics. And I want to invite you to think with me about that today. So I'm going to begin in 2 Peter 3. We're going to jump down to verse number 3 and start right in that place where Peter says, "Know this first of all, that in the last days, mockers will come with their mocking." Can we just pause right there and think about that? Peter says, mockers will come with their mocking. And as I read that, the first thing that occurred to me is that this problem of dealing with skeptics is not a new problem, that it has always been a problem, because right here, Peter says, these people are dealing with it, right? In fact, it's interesting. He didn't call them skeptics. He calls them mockers or scoffers. And that is language loaded with significance. These are people who don't just disagree. They denigrate. They look down on people of faith and ridicule them. In fact, if you jump ahead to verse number 4, he describes some of their ridicule. Verse 4, saying, here's what the mockers say, "Where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all continues as it was from the beginning of creation." In other words, these mockers are saying, people who believe the Lord's coming back, where is that coming from? Nothing's changed from the very beginning. They're ridiculing them for believing that the Lord is going to come back. Does that sound familiar? Where is your God? You know, they're not the first people to say that. All the way back to Psalm 42 and verse 10. There were even mockers back then saying that to the psalmist. Psalm 42 verse 10, he says, "My bones suffer from mortal agony as my foes taunt me, saying all day long, where is your God?" In this case, his enemies are saying to you, boy, if you're a good guy, why isn't God helping you out? And as I thought about that, my mind came to the New Testament, to Matthew 27, and I thought about Jesus, who had to deal with his own mockers. Thinking about at the cross, Matthew 27, verse 39, the text says, "Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, 'You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God.'" Do you hear them at the cross? Jesus had to deal with mockers too. In fact, verse 41 says, "In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law and the elders mocked him. 'He saved others,' they said, 'but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And I love verse 44. It adds that in the same way, the rebels who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. Think about that. The people who were going by, all the important religious people, even the two guys being killed with him are ridiculing him on the cross. Jesus had to deal with mockers too. So should any of us be surprised today when people come along and say, "Where is your God? I mean, if there's really a God there, why didn't he present himself? Why doesn't he show himself so we can all know and believe him?" Ever had someone say that? Where was God on 9/11? Or insert whatever current tragedy you want to. Well, if there really is this good God ruling over the world, you'd think he'd do something about those 3 airplanes, wouldn't you? Where is your God? I think the lesson, brothers and sisters, going back to Psalms, looking at the cross, looking at this letter, the lesson is that God's people have always been dealing with skeptics and scoffers and mockers. And so we need to anticipate that we will too. And if I could go to that concern I have that underlies this, right, about our kids. I think, brothers and sisters, we need to teach our kids to be anticipating the skeptics. I think sometimes our kids grow up a little bit in a bubble, don't they? Not that they don't know that the skeptics are out there, but a lot of their growing up years, if mom and dad are real faithful and bring them to church and associate them with their disciples, they kind of grow up in a bubble, sort of surrounded by lots and lots of other people who see the world exactly the way that they do. And maybe they don't appreciate just how many out there don't see the world that way and how much our world is changing, even year by year. Skepticism is growing. I think our kids need to realize that. We need to help them see the reality of the world that they're living in and to anticipate, especially when they go off to school to get their education, like Sarah was trying to do, that not only are they going to face people who see the world differently, but they may find themselves under assault in an increasingly hostile world. I'm not trying to go dark on you here. But that's the reality, brothers and sisters. In fact, let me say to parents who've got young people, that needs to be a big factor when you start thinking about college. What kind of environment, what kind of setting is that going to be? Because it is not the same at every school. When we start thinking about where our kids are going to go, it needs to be a whole lot more than, well, this is the family heritage, or listen, this is a very prestigious school, or the scholarship is really big. Let me tell you what's going to matter in 4 or 5 years. What's the condition of my kids' faith? That's what's going to matter. And so I need to be thinking about what kind of setting I'm putting my kids in. You know what needs to matter most, folks? What kind of church is going to be there? What kind of assault may they have to deal with on that prestigious university campus? And we need to be thinking about 1 Peter 3. Will you flip back there? We've been in 2 Peter 3. Back up to 1 Peter 3. Remember this admonition that the Holy Spirit gives us through Peter, starting in verse 13. This is 1 Peter 3, verse 13. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled. Watch this, verse 15. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence, and keep a good conscience, so that in the thing in which you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ will be put to shame. For it is better, if God should will it so, that you suffer for doing what is right rather than for doing what is wrong. Back up to 15. Always being ready to make a defense. I got to tell you, folks, to the best of our ability, we need to get our kids ready to give an answer, to know that there are answers for the skeptic's challenge. Because like every generation of disciples, they're going to have to face off with the mockers too, just like we do. Now, go back to 2 Timothy 3, because there's something else that I want you to see in this text I think is really important. Remember that in verses 3 and 4, he kind of tells us what these mockers are up to and the theological controversy that they're stirring. Remember, he says that the mockers will come with their mocking, saying in verse 4, where is the promise of his coming? We'll get to that in just a minute. But I want you to notice something there that I've passed over both time I've read that. And now I want to give it our special attention. As he talks about this theological controversy, right in the middle of that, notice that he says that these mockers follow after their own lust. Do you see that at the end of verse 3? That is not a new topic. He has been talking about the immorality of these mockers all through the letter. I mean, go back to chapter 2. He has a lot to say about it. He says in verse 2, and many are going to follow their sensuality. In verse 13 of chapter 2, he says, they revel in the daytime. Man, they're just all out of the open about this. That sounds familiar too, doesn't it? Verse 14, they have eyes full of adultery. He's been talking about their immorality all through the letter. But I want you to notice that right here, as he's dealing with their theological controversy, he inserts it right back in there. Do you see that? They come with their mocking, following after their own lust. Why does he put that there? I think he wants us to see a connection, the connection that exists between their mocking and their immorality. You see, brothers and sisters, if a person is determined to disobey, he's got to deal with the God problem if he's going to do that. He's got to find a way to get God out of the picture. And these mockers have found their way to do that. They just decided that the Lord isn't going to come and that there isn't going to be any judgment. And so will I be accountable for how I behave so I can do whatever I want to do? But here's the thing that I need you to see with me this morning. This is really, really important. They didn't reject the idea of Jesus coming because of the evidence. This isn't about evidence at all. They rejected the idea of Jesus coming because it was getting away of their lifestyle. Do you see that? It's difficult to run around fornicating when you know Jesus is going to come and judge you for it. In this case, it was their desire to misbehave that was driving their skepticism. Do you see that? So what's going on is there is this unspoken agenda, a moral agenda, that's really behind the theological controversy. I wanted you to think with me about that this morning because I think we continue to struggle with that today. That skepticism is not always about truth and evidence. Sometimes it's about justifying a lifestyle. Now, Jeff and I spent a lot of time talking about that this week because I really don't want to be unfair in talking about the skeptics. And so in an effort to be fair, I need to say that I am not suggesting that all skepticism is driven by some base, unhidden desire to behave immorally, okay? But on the other hand, it would be naive to believe that all doubt is driven strictly by the strength of evidence or the weight of the arguments being made. In fact, Jeff would want me to say that more often than not, there is a moral component to all of this. So if you disagree with that, I just threw him under the bus. But I think wisdom requires that we recognize the possibility that there may be an unspoken agenda behind people's doubt and skepticism. I've seen some of that. I follow a guy who does a lot of work on college campuses, Dr. Frank Turek, and he interacts in that setting with a lot of young atheists on those campuses. And it's interesting, one of the things he likes to do when he is taking questions and answers from them is he will ask these young atheists, if I could prove to you that Christianity is true, would you be a Christian? Think about that question. If I could prove that it's true, would you be a Christian? And the astonishing thing is that he actually has kids who say no. Think about that. If I could prove to you Christianity is true, would you be a Christian? And the kids say, no, which proves what? This isn't about the evidence. It's about the will. There are some people who do not want to believe. There's something else going on. I ran into that actually with a friend of mine many years ago. His young family was part of the church family that I was working with, and his wife came in one Sunday and said, you need to come talk to my husband. There's a problem. And so I went by the house immediately next week and sat down to talk to him, and he says, I have decided that I don't believe in God. Which is kind of a bizarre thing to talk to a guy who's a Christian who all of a sudden says, I don't believe in God anymore. So I began to dig a little bit. I asked him, I said, well, did you run across some evidence that's made you doubt? He said, no. I said, well, did someone ask you a question you couldn't answer? No. I said, well, did something happen in your life that's led you to conclude there must not be a God in heaven? He said, no. And I'm thinking, what is the problem? How do you wake up one day and decide there's not a God? And I don't think that's what happened to this guy. 2 weeks before, he'd fallen off the wagon. This young man with a family had a serious problem with alcohol, and one of our good shepherds had come to his house and said, look, this is the third time. We got to deal with this problem. This is going to destroy your life. And he said, so me and you, we're going to connect with AA. We're going to some meetings. We're going to get this problem fixed. And within 2 weeks, he didn't believe in God anymore. I'm a little suspicious, brothers and sisters, that lifestyle was driving skepticism. And as our kids go off to Lubbock or College Station or Austin, did I at least cover the big ones? I think they need to understand that the professors that they will listen to can also be driven by hidden agendas. I think it's important to tell kids that because I think sometimes they don't have a very accurate view of their professors and the scientists at work at their university. I think sometimes kids look at their professors and they say to themselves, these guys are just driven by the data. They're just driven by the facts, the evidence. Whatever it says, that's what they're going to believe. And they don't realize that the truth is even the guys in the white lab coats are just like the rest of us. And influenced and pressured by the same things that impact and influence all of us too. For example, college professors want to have the approval of their peers too. And they want to get promoted on their job. They want tenure. And yes, even college professors sometimes are trying to justify lifestyle choices. And all of those things can influence how they choose to see the evidence just like anybody else. Kids need to understand that. It would serve you well to spend some time considering the story of Dr. Dean Kenyon. He was a biology professor at the University of San Francisco. And frankly, he was a Darwinist. He believed in Darwin's theory of evolution and was actively involved in research, helping to confirm that theory, especially the chemical aspect of that, the chemical processes by which life came to exist through Darwin's theory. Actually wrote a college textbook on that subject. But as he continued his research, and particularly as he began to deal with questions and pushback, even from his own students in class, he began to doubt even his own theories. And so in his classroom, he began to be honest about that and share some of his doubt and uncertainty with his students. You know how that shook out with him? It took him out of the classroom, folks. They wouldn't let him teach because he was honest about what he was finding in his research. Now, he had tenure, so they couldn't fire him. But they wouldn't let the students hear him. Question, you think the other professors at San Francisco State University watching that situation felt some pressure to toe the line on evolution? Sometimes there can be an unspoken agenda that influences how people look at the data, even the guys in the white lab coats. And so as we think about sending our kids off to Austin or College Station or Lubbock or wherever, I think that they need to know that that can be the case, that there's good reason to be a little skeptical of the skeptics. And as we're thinking about that, and I'm looking at the text of 2 Peter 3, I'm thinking about something else too, that sometimes skeptics can ignore evidence. And I say that because that is exactly what's going on in 2 Peter 3. Will you look back at our text? Sometimes skeptics can ignore evidence. So after explaining what they're saying in verse 4, where is the promise of his coming? Peter will continue in verse 5, for when they maintain this, it escapes their notice. When they make this claim that everything's been going on from the beginning and nothing's changed and nothing's going to change, Peter says, when they say that, well, my translation says it escapes their notice. And that might leave you with the impression that there's something that they don't know. And that's not actually what Peter is trying to say. If you're reading from the ESV this morning, I think it translates it better. ESV says, they deliberately overlook this fact. Or the New King James says, they willfully forget. So this isn't about someone who just doesn't know something. These are about people who are choosing to overlook facts that would definitely change the way they perceive this situation. You see that? As I read that, it occurred to me that we deal with the same problem. Skeptics who choose to overlook facts, evidence. I think we had a great example of that right here in Texas about 10 or 12 years ago. There was a great controversy going on over in Austin about the guidelines for teaching science in the public school system. Specifically, one part of that controversy was there were some people who wanted to remove language in those guidelines who said teachers must teach both the strengths and weaknesses of Darwin's theory of evolution. And there were some voices saying, we need to take out that part of the language that says you must teach the weaknesses. Teachers shouldn't be required to do that. Some people who wanted to change it in that way. And so the question was raised, well, why do you want to take that part out? And the answer was, because Darwin's theory of evolution doesn't have any weaknesses. In fact, some of our folks over in Beaumont were really, really caught up in that controversy and did some work over in Austin. There was some stuff about it written in the local newspaper, and they interviewed a professor from Lamar University who said that Darwin's theory has no weaknesses, which when I read was astonishing to me that somebody would make a claim like that. No weaknesses? I'm thinking even, you know, wherever you come down on the theory of evolution, I mean, anybody who knows anything about the theory knows that it has its challenges, right? I mean, I got some problem with the fossil record, folks. The fossil record doesn't quite work like Darwin's theory says it was supposed to work. In fact, even one of the leading proponents of evolution says sometimes it looks like it works better with Genesis, which was an interesting admission, I thought. And then all the transitional forms needed for the theory to work, they're not finding that in the fossil record. That's a problem. But I don't think it's the bigger problems. I think when you're trying to explain the origin of life and you've got to talk about aliens visiting the planet and seeding the earth with simple life forms, when aliens are the answer to one of your big problems, I think there's some weaknesses with the theory. How about you? Or maybe worst of all, when someone goes back to the very beginning and explains it this way, first there was nothing, and then out of the nothing came something. When something from nothing is how you start, I think that's a weakness, don't you? So I think it's reasonable to say that when someone comes along and says that Darwin theory has no weaknesses, they're doing exactly what these mockers were in 2 Peter 3. They're just ignoring some stuff. Well, it was interesting that those who pushed for this change argued and justified it by saying, well, if you teach the weaknesses, it will confuse the students. Really? In what way? I mean, folks, if the goal is to find truth, how do you find truth except to put all the evidence on the table and decide where the data leads you, right? Now, if I just want you to believe my story about this, well, then I just give you the evidence that supports my story. Every parent with children understands that. You come home and the lamp is broken and you begin interrogating the children. And what do you get? A story that makes them look good. Leaving out all kinds of data that may not look good for them. They only give you the evidence that makes them look good, right? How that works. It's not about truth. It's about not getting grounded. The history of all of this, I think, is really interesting. You realize, folks, that 100 years ago, the goal of the evolutionists was just to get them to allow human evolution to be taught in the school system. Some states had actually outlawed that. And once there was give on that. And they allowed the teaching of evolution in the public school system. Then the battle was to get the Bible out of it, the whole separation of church and state thing. Can't have the Bible in the classroom. And over several decades, they were successful at literally pushing the Bible out of the classroom so you couldn't talk about God and Genesis even more. Then the next battle line was, and we don't want them talking about an intelligent designer, because a little 15-year-old kid hears intelligent designer, he's going to think about what he learned about God in Bible class, and we can't have any of that in the public classroom. And so now, at least in some places, it's illegal for you to do that. You can't talk about even an intelligent designer. And now that all that's done, you think it's finished, but it's not, because now what they want to do is they want to eliminate even the discussion of the weaknesses of the theory they're advancing. And so what I'm trying to say this morning is that I think our kids need to know that. When they go off to Lubbock or Austin or College Station and they're sitting in the biology classroom and the professor is building this mountain of evidence for the theory of evolution, I just think kids need to know that's not all the evidence. I think they need to understand that over decades, a determined effort has been made that they don't get to hear the whole story, only part of the story and the evidence that supports the story they want to tell. And I think we need to supply them with that other evidence. There's some great books out there. Michael Behe's done a terrific book, Darwin's Black Box. Stephen Jay Maier's got a great book, Signature in the Cell. It's a great starting point for kids to consider other views of the scientific evidence, and maybe views that won't be talked about in class. Which brings me to the last thing that I want to say this morning, and that is, let's remember that the skeptics can be answered, because that's what Peter does. That's what he's doing right here in 2 Peter 3. They've made this argument, where is the promise of his coming? Because everything from the beginning has just gone on, and it's just been unchanged. And remember that Peter says, wait a minute, when they say that, they're ignoring some things. And so he goes on to talk about that. I'm picking up in verse 5. For when they maintain this, it escapes their notice that by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago, and the earth was formed out of water and by water, through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. By his word, the present heaven and earth are being preserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. Peter says, when they tell you that everything's been going on from the beginning, just so, and nothing's changed, he said, that's not true. He says, in fact, God has already broken through and brought judgment. Noah, the flood, that story proves that everything hadn't just been continuing the beginning unchanged. They're choosing to ignore that, which, by the way, is a part of the story that changes everything. And so what Peter says in the rest of this letter is you need to be sure you don't ignore that. And recognize that judgment is coming. And that because of that, it should impact how we're living our lives every single day. What is he doing? He's answering the skeptic. He's putting more evidence on the table, which actually shows that what they're saying isn't true. So a couple of takeaways from that. Number one, what we really need to be telling our kids is that modern skeptics can be answered too. I need to emphasize to you how important that is. Because I think just like Sarah, you can really get rattled when you get hit with something that you've never heard before, that you didn't anticipate. I mean, folks, we can't cover everything. Stuff is going to come up. Arguments are going to be made. Criticisms are going to be launched that kids have not anticipated. And so one of the things we need to be saying to them is, just because you haven't heard it before doesn't mean it's new. Doesn't mean no one's ever heard it before. In fact, the truth is, brothers and sisters, the criticisms that critics make about our faith, most of those things have been around for centuries and centuries, and disciples have answered them over and over and over again. So when someone comes along, your kid, and says, listen, all this evil and suffering that's going on in the world today, it's just proof that you cannot have a good and loving God ruling over the world. How long have the atheists been making that argument? And how long have disciples been answering that argument? It's a bad argument. And so what kids need to know is, just because that's new to you doesn't mean it's new. Doesn't mean it hadn't been answered. Just because you don't know the answer doesn't mean that there isn't one. And then secondly, we need to recognize it's going to take some work to find those answers, be ready to deal with the skeptics. Folks, we're living in a season where a shallow faith isn't going to cut it anymore. Not for us. And not for our kids. And so we need to be readying them to know why they believe what they believe. And we need to recognize that finding the answers is absolutely vital. Why? Because of what Peter is saying in this letter. The skeptics are wrong. Jesus is going to come back. And when he comes back, men are going to be judged. And heaven or hell is hanging in the balance. And, as Peter says, so what kind of people ought you to be? That's the challenge for me and you. Because that's true. Who should we be and what should we do? What should you do right now? Maybe there's someone in this audience that has found a way to get God out of the way and it's let you misbehave. And maybe Peter's teaching here brings you back to reality that Jesus is coming and there will be judgment and you're not ready for him. So what are you going to do about that? You need to find your way back to the Lord more than anything. He wants that. This group of disciples wants to help you with that. So if you need to do that, you could let us know by making your way to the front right now. While we stand, while we sing together.